Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. This past summer, physician John Sarno died one day before his 94th birthday. Dr. Sarno spent more than 50 years as a doctor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at the Rusk Institute at New York University. Sarno became well known because of his books, including Healing Back Pain and The Mind-Body Prescription. He developed a devoted following because of the number and variety of people he helped through their own severe back pain, including celebrities like Howard Stern, Anne Bancroft, and Larry David. My guest today, David Galinsky, is a documentary filmmaker and one of a trio behind the new film, All the Rage, Saved by Sarno, which will be shown here in Tulsa on October 26th at Circle Cinema. Galinsky and his colleagues spent more than a decade putting the 94-minute film together, gathering interviews, raising money, and finishing final edits before going out on the film festival circuit this summer and fall. Stumped creatively, Galinsky took the unusual step of putting himself into the narrative as he suffered through his own bout of horrific back pain and sought the counsel of Dr. Sarno, after initially resisting it because it was recommended by his father. Dr. Sarno, though hailed by his patients, was derided as somewhat of a quack by many of his physician colleagues who never referred patients to him. Though in his New York Times obituary, it stated that those same physicians often consulted Dr. Sarno for their own back pain. David Galinsky, filmmaker and co-director of All the Rage, Saved by Sarno, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Michael Galinsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Let me start by just asking you, for those who are unaware, who was John Sarno?
Dr. Sarno was a professor of rehabilitation medicine at New York University, and he started there at the Rusk Institute in like 1965, and that was after he already had started the first cooperative in New York State, first medical cooperative, and then he went on to work at NYU.
And what makes him special? What makes him worthy of a documentary about his life?
Well, he was a very inquisitive person. He said he always had like Sherlock Holmes by his bed. He really liked mysteries. He liked to kind of zoom in and try and figure out what something was going on. Notice the thing that other people weren't noticing. That was just a general fact about him. But he worked at the Rusk Institute for Rehabilitative Medicine. At the time, he was doing the things that he had been taught to do, which was bed rest and physical therapy, hot and cold, electrical stimulation, things like that. But he found that the patients really weren't getting better. And at the time, it was an inpatient program. People with really bad back pain would come and stay in the hospital for weeks at a time.
Right, and that's so, just so hard to imagine now, you know, yeah. In the current climate of drive-through hospitalizations.
Exactly. But when people weren't getting better, he decided to look at the data that supported all of the things that he'd been taught. And he found there just wasn't any that supported it. There was just standard care. It's what people had been taught to do. But it wasn't based on science. It wasn't based on randomized control trials or anything except experience or just actually lack of experience. They just didn't know what to do, so that's what they did. They tried things, but they didn't really help. So then he looked at his patients' charts, and he found that more than 80% of them had a history of things that were known to be psychosomatic, things like ulcers, colitis, migraines, eczema, things that people had for a long time connected with a mind-body interaction. So he started to talk to his patients and find out a little bit more about them to really figure out what was going on in their lives that might be a contributing factor. And through that, he came to see that a really large majority of his patients, and you know, he was at NYU in the 30s in New York City, were people who really pushed themselves to excel, to take care of other people, to live up to a sense of themselves that was someone who did for others. He called them goodists, people who were, you know, they were really nice people who always worked hard for people. They weren't always nice, but they always were really driven people. But a lot of them were nice. And what he found with that trait was something that they had to kind of repress their emotions in order to do that, and that he had a background in medicine at the time when Freud was still somewhat in vogue, before the whole biotechnical aspect of medicine had totally come into power, and that the emotions were pushed to the side as being unscientific. You can't mess with them. They're murky. You can't control for them. You can't measure them. So let's just focus on the things that we can measure, is where it had come to. But he found that when he simply got his patients to make the connection between the way they possibly repressed their emotions and the back pain that was going on, they started to get better. When they made that connection, when they kind of owned a sense of, oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. You know, he'd give an example of, like, say he had a patient who's, you know, you ask what's going on in your life. Well, you know, let's see, blah, blah, blah. You know, my mother-in-law lives with us. She was supposed to be there a month, but now it's been 2 years. It's great, though, because she picks up the kids from school. And he'd say, well, that must be kind of enraging that she's still there. And they go, no, no. And he'd kind of push it. Well, yeah, it is a little bit frustrating, but you have to do what you have to do. And when he got them to kind of recognize they weren't being present with the fact that it did bother them, that maybe was a causative factor. And when he got people to recognize it, they got better. And so he just developed this over time, over many, many years, because this was in the early 70s when he started to realize this. And he started to have a lot of success treating patients that way.
So he went on to write several books, really, about back pain and healing back pain without medication or certainly without surgery. And these books were not promoted, but they seemed to do really well by word of mouth.
Entirely by word of mouth. And as did his practice. So he started to have a very robust practice because people got better and they told two friends and they told two friends. So, you know, but in the 70s and 80s and 90s, he had a very robust practice. And then one of his patients was someone who worked in publishing. And so he suggested this idea of writing a book. Actually, he kind of primed them to ask him if he had thought about it. He said, yes, I have. And that was, I think, Mind Over Back Pain, or it was the mind-body one first. And then he just continued to develop the ideas. And the last book he published was The Divided Mind, which is much more of a science book, which kind of delves into the science and has many chapters by other practitioners talking about the way these things work and how the physiological process happens. But what he was trying to do was not write a book for practitioners early on. It was just a way to communicate the very simple idea and to kind of counteract everything people had been taught about the physicality of their problem that didn't make sense to him. So, for instance, when people came in before MRIs with myelographs that showed that there was a herniation in a disc, they would come to him with those and say, I need to get fixed. And he would look at them and find that they had pain in three or four different areas, sometimes, oftentimes, none of which actually correlated where the pain would be if it had been a herniated disc. So he was very skeptical of that. And over time, he's actually been proven to be correct with MRIs. There's not a causal correlation if you're actually looking at it from a scientific perspective, between a herniation and pain. So, for instance, you could do an MRI in 300 people randomly, and you give those scans to somebody who's supposed to tell you who has pain, and it doesn't really, they can't tell you, because people who have terrible-looking herniations might have no pain, and people who have nothing going on in terms of what they could see physically and have terrible pain. So, you know, if you were looking at it from a scientific perspective, you would say, I can't say that that causes that.
Yeah, and that's what's, I think, been so disquieting to people in the medical community when we reflect on that data. But Dr. Sarno, he's portrayed at least as somewhat of an iconoclast, but that's not really, that wasn't really his personality, but maybe it was. I mean, he certainly, his colleagues at NYU didn't seem to appreciate what he was doing. How did the administration there view him?
I never talked to the administration. I think they basically, he was very respected when Howard Rusk was still there. And, you know, he was very much a part of the program. But when Howard Rusk retired, he started to slowly lose favor as this kind of more biotechnical approach came into being. And so he just kind of got ignored. He went into private practice within the university. He had his office there, but had got no referrals from anybody in that system. And I wouldn't say he set out to be an iconoclast. I think what happened was he realized this was going on. He told people in his field, and they ignored him. And they said he was a quack, like Semmelweis. Semmelweis was the Hungarian doctor who recognized that it was doctors not washing their hands between dealing with women in childbirth that was the cause of sepsis. He couldn't figure out why that was, but he wrote a paper about it. He told people, they laughed at him, they ran him out of town, and he died in an insane asylum. Only many years later, when germ theory came to exist, they understood that he had seen what it was. He didn't know what it was. He couldn't see exactly what it was, but he understood what was going on. And I think there's something similar with Dr. Sarno. Now, he'd be the first person to say, I'm not saying anything new. You know, people knew this at a certain point, but as we see in the kind of paradigm shifts of science, it comes in a favor and out of favor. And there's a quote that we didn't actually have in the movie, but we do have online on one of our posts, where he says, you know, in the 19th century, doctors believed that all mental illness was caused by a disease of the brain. And so they saw it as something physical. And then Freud came in, and that kind of shifted a little bit, and there was more of a balance between the mind and the body. He says, now, they say it's all chemical, but it's all the same thing. It's like they're refusing to kind of see that this interplay between the mind and the body, and people want it to be something that they can give you a pill or an injection or an electrical shock or surgery so that those with power can fix it rather than recognizing that there's a very complex interplay between the way in which we view the world and ourselves and how that then affects our body. And the last line of the movie is, it all comes down to one simple idea. The mind and the body are intimately related. That's it. That's the whole story. And so oftentimes we'll get into discussions with people who say, well, he didn't have it exactly right. He said it was oxygen being deprived, and there's no data to prove that, although there is some data that shows that. That was very convincing to my brother. But for me, as a filmmaker, I'm not a scientist. I'm a storyteller. And like Dr. Sarno, I'm more interested probably in the metaphor. And so for me, it makes perfect sense that the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are going to shape our sense of who we are. That doesn't mean that we don't have genes that already prime us to think a certain way or respond a certain way in the world, but the interplay between those two is vast and complex. And so Dr. Sarno never said the pain is all in your head. Instead, he said that the pain is related to how your body is processing its sense of what's going on. So that's a much more complex and nuanced view, but that's really hard for people to understand. And that's what he faced all through his career, was he was telling people this, but they were saying, so you're saying it's all in my head, and they just rejected him out of hand. And that's how he became kind of an iconoclast by force.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Michael Galinsky. He's a filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, and he has made his most recent film is called All the Rage, Saved by Sarno, which is a documentary about the life of Dr. John Sarno, who was a rehabilitation specialist at the Rusk Institute at New York University, who also wrote several best-selling books about healing back pain, really by psychological insight, much more so than any kind of physical therapy, medical treatment, or surgery. Dr. Sarno came up with a term or a TMS.
A diagnosis.
Diagnosis. Thank you. What tell us about TMS, what it means.
When he first came up with the term, it was tension myositis syndrome, meaning that it was tension in the muscles, but he later amended that to be tension myoneural system. So in other words, that it was an interaction between the neural reaction, the nerve reaction to stress causing the pain through different physiological means. And he carried out that diagnosis by carefully examining patients, ruling out a structural abnormality such as a cracked vertebrae or a tumor or something that could be causing the pain. So he would look at MRIs, he would look at people's history, and then he would also look at their personality history, but he would also examine them all over. And one of the things he found was that people often had pain in several different places. So maybe their left shoulder hurt, but if he palpitated the flesh on the other side, it was also very painful to the touch. So he started to see that it was a systems problem rather than an individual thing, rather than a pathology.
I want to tell our listeners how you came to be so interested in Dr. Sarno. And there's much more than a bit, actually, of a personal connection, because your father was a patient of Dr. Sarno, but then you and your brother both became patients of Dr. Sarno. So I guess, start with you. How did you become a Dr. Sarno devotee?
Well, the film is very much about Dr. Sarno and his work, but it's equally a personal story. And it's that personal story that helps people to make a personal and emotional connection to what's going on in the film. So if it had just been a story about Dr. Sarno and his history, which many people wanted it to be, it wouldn't have had the kind of same connective process that it does for many people. But my father, you know, when I was a kid, he almost died of a bleeding ulcer. And that's something that Dr. Sarno points out in the film, is that certain things become in vogue and unconsciously affect people. So under Eisenhower, everyone knew that, you know, like certain jobs were three ulcer jobs, that ulcers were caused by stress. And then later they became able to treat them through drugs and stuff, and ulcers stopped being as much of a problem. You stopped hearing about them, and you started to hear about back pain and RSI. But my dad almost died of a bleeding ulcer when I was in second grade. And a few months later, when he got better, we had a fender bender, just literally a nothing accident. The car, I was in the car, 5 miles an hour, and he got horrible whiplash, right, from this non-accident that plagued him for years. He would come home from work, and he would get in one of these traction devices that lifted his neck, and he was just in constant pain.
Oh,
and a few years later, someone gave him a copy of Dr. Sarno's book. And as a psychologist, he immediately understood that it made perfect sense, and he got better for the most part. He wasn't completely cured of, you know, all of his emotional ills, but his whiplash alleviated, and he was a penurious man. He grew up in the Depression, poor. So he didn't like to spend a lot of money, but he ordered a box of the books, and he gave it to everybody who ever mentioned they had back pain. And he was just very vocal about how powerful the book was.
You yourself, you experienced back pain, but were kind of reluctant, I think, to initially sign up with Dr. Sarno. Why was that?
For, you know, a lot of reasons that we resist the things that our parents tell us. You know, we're resistant. Because also, you know, my father was a psychologist. My mother was a social worker. And when you grow up in that environment and maybe they aren't as responsible as they might be as adults, you're kind of skeptical about those worlds. So for me, I have kind of a some skepticism about that. I also want to do everything for myself. But anyway, like flash forward a couple years after my dad got better, maybe 5 or 6, my brother got RSI in graduate school when he was putting himself under intense pressure to kind of follow in my father's footsteps as an academic. And he literally could not drive. He could not type. He couldn't do anything. He gave me his car because he couldn't drive, because he couldn't use his hands.
This is a repetitive stress injury, right? And this was due to typing
it was ostensibly due to the way you sat in your chair or you typed, but nobody could fathom that it might have to do with the emotions at all. And in fact, my brother went to the expert on RSI, who then told him he had to have bone carved away from his collarbone to free the nerves that went from his neck to his hands.
Did he do that?
Even though it was both hands. No, that's when my dad screamed at him. He said, "I'm going to disown you if you don't go see Dr. Sarno." So my brother finally went to see him in New York because he was at Princeton. And 3 weeks later, he called me up and he said, "I want my car back." Literally. I mean, he had the very first, it was like a $5,000 software program called Dragon Dictate that he got a grant for so he could stay in graduate school because he just couldn't do it otherwise. And he had a really amazing recovery. And that's when I read the book. At that point, my back would go out once or twice a year. Nothing horrific. I mean, it would be very painful for 2 or 3 days, but I would be back up and around. It wasn't debilitating in any way, and it didn't seem chronic. It wasn't chronic. But reading the book, I found myself on every page where he described kind of the way people repress their emotions, their childhoods, their whole story, et cetera. It just sounded like me, and it made perfect sense. So from then on, when I would start to maybe feel a twinge, or if my back would go out even for like an hour, I would just focus on what was going on or what I might be mad at. And for 10 years, I was fine. I didn't have another bad back episode until I had a movie I was trying to get out. I had a 2-year-old. We were trying to fix up a house. And then I just got increasingly, I started to come back in this powerful way. I couldn't walk. It got worse and worse. And then I was just slammed to the floor in such incredible pain. It took like 5 Vicodin to get me in a car to get me home.
Oh my gosh.
And that's when I went and had an MRI. And even though I knew about Dr. Sarno and I was reading the book hadn't helped me and I was broke, you know, I didn't have insurance. So finally my brother was like, "I'll pay for it. Just go see him." And so that's when I finally went to see him. And I didn't have a miraculous recovery, but I did begin to recover finally. And I slowly got better. And that's when I said to him, "Can we make a movie?" And he was ready for it. But the world was not. And so we couldn't make that movie. That was 2004. And so we started to try and shoot. We couldn't figure out how to make the movie because in order to make a movie, you have to have a character who's kind of willing to be somewhat naked and real and totally present on camera. But Dr. Sarno was a bit more like The Wizard of Oz. He wanted his ideas out there. He wanted them talked about, but he didn't want to be a character. He didn't want to be that person and reveal himself in that way because he wanted to be a professional.
Mm-hmm.
And so we only shot like 3.5 hours of footage in the first 2.5 years, and we just couldn't figure out how to do it. We couldn't get any funding. We applied for all these grants. We're never very good at that anyway, but we just couldn't figure out, and it kind of tapered off until it happened again about 7 or 8 years later, and that's when I was on the floor screaming in pain. I yelled, "Grab the camera. We're making this damn movie."
It was born through crisis, literally.
As it happened. I mean, it was a crazy moment of incredible pain, and yet I knew at that moment that, okay, I have to be the character, which is something I had avoided doing. I didn't want to be in the film at all. And I realized that was the only way that we were going to be able to emotionally tell the story.
You're in the film. This is it's as much about your ordeal and interacting with Dr. Sarno. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Chu. And my guest today is filmmaker Michael Galinsky. He is the director of the documentary All the Rage, Saved by Sarno, a documentary about the life and career of Dr. John Sarno. And it's going to screen in Tulsa on Thursday, October 26th at the Circle Cinema at 7:30.
Two quick things. One is I'm a co-director on it because there were 3 of us who made this movie. And because I'm in it, people tend to focus more on me. But I made it with my wife, Suki Hawley, and another partner, David Baylinson. And we've worked on, I think, upwards of 6 or 7 feature-length documentaries together. And it's more of like a collaborative effort. And then that you do have to go to the Gather website in order to get the tickets. Enough people have to sign up to make it happen. And it's close to having that happen, but it's a strange system. Because there's so much resistance to the movie, we have to use this kind of crowdfunding way of getting it seen, crowdsourcing.
That is correct. And we will have that link on our website.
Great.
And Michael, I was curious, you know, you talk about the mind-body connection, and Dr. Mm-hmm. Sarno certainly does. So he is pretty much, I think it's safe to say, like a disciple of Freud. And in fact, functions. I mean, one of the reasons that I think he had such a struggle of getting his ideas adopted is because here he was in physical medicine and rehabilitation, really espousing kind of psychiatric ideas, or the way at least the medical profession has siloed these concepts, you know, for, I will say exactly. In this case, for worse, but sometimes for better. And so he was maybe like a fish out of water or just in a different silo. And so that was part of his struggle. But was your sense that maybe he was miscast and should have been in psychiatry, or that somehow?
No. He was very much a doctor of physical medicine, but he was also an intelligent person who understood the complexity that they were interrelated. They aren't separate things, right? It's not like you have the mind and then you have the body. And that's all, you know, a leftover of Cartesian way of looking at the world, in which the church said, you know, hey, Renee, if you keep talking about the brain, we're going to take yours. And so he had to kind of separate them out. And the whole medical practice is that way. Like they said, okay, psychology and psychiatry are over here, and here's the medicine, and the, you know, the twain will not meet, which is a ludicrous way of looking at a system, because they aren't separate. They're a unified system. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's even very fair to call him a devotee of Freud. Instead, what he did was he looked at what he had been taught, which is what Freud was talking about, and also what physical medicine was talking about, and how they interacted. Because before we had this system in which everything was biotechnical, people looked at things in complex ways. And I think one of the problems with our medicine, the way we practice it now, is that we say things have to be measurable, and we have to be able to see them or we can't believe them. And if you look carefully, like, for instance, the limbic system, until 2-3 years ago, it stopped at the neck, because they couldn't see the little microscopic vein that went from the neck up and covered the entire brain. Some guys at Johns Hopkins finally discovered this a couple years ago. So that, for instance, they said, okay, the limbic system, which regulates all of the immune response, isn't connected to the brain. And they would, if you tried to argue with people that it was, they'd say, no, there's no proof. That's woo. You're out of your mind. Until finally they found it. So these people, I mean, this is true. You can look it up. This Johns Hopkins study, I think 2013, they somehow found it in the embedded. They're so small you can't see them, but it is the limbic system. So it's connected to every part of the brain. And this idea that our immune response is separate from our emotions is ludicrous. I mean, we all know that when we're stressed out, we get sick. There's tons of scientific studies that show that. So if stress makes us more susceptible to illness, like a cold, why would it not make us more susceptible to any other illness?
Right. When you're saying limbic, do you mean lymphatic system or the limbic?
Maybe a
okay. Yeah.
Maybe
right.
The lymphatic system. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So limbic is the kind of your proto brain, your so-called reptilian brain, the oldest part, like the diencephalon.
Right. But the limbic and the lymphatic are connected, because it's that proto brain that actually does a lot of the stress response unconsciously. And you know, there's a doctor. I don't even think he's a doctor. He was in medical school. He got chronic fatigue. He dropped out and figured it all out, what was going on for him. His name's Ashok Gupta, and he describes it this way. Say you're walking somewhere, and you almost get hit by a bus because you're not paying attention. It's your flight or fight. Your amygdala jumps in and pulls you back on the curb, right? But at that point, if your amygdala checks in with your frontal cortex and says, our bus is scary, and if you consciously think buses are scary, now your amygdala says, okay, buses are scary. Every time I see a bus, I'm going to get you ready. And so these things that we're not even conscious of being afraid of, our body responds as if they're a physical threat, be it a test, be it going to see your mother-in-law. And so without even being conscious of it, our body is flooded with stress hormones. Now, if you multiply this over 1,000 small emotional stresses over the course of a day that you're not conscious of, think about what that does to your body.
Right. One of the, almost out of time, but one of the things I wanted to ask you about also was Dr. Sarno. There was this very lovely obituary about him in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. He died this summer, a day before his 94th birthday, right around the time your film was being released. So it's almost like he kind of made it to the finish line in terms of the film, although he had retired, it sounds like, because the building that he was in at NYU, I guess, shut down in 2012, and so he had sort of nowhere else to go. But one of the things that the obituary mentions that you sort of allude to in the film, he was being sort of an outcast, I guess, from some of his mm-hmm. NYU colleagues, and yet many of these same people who would speak disparagingly about him would see him as patients. And I just wondered, you did reference the fact that it was hard, or he didn't want to, for a variety of reasons, I'm sure wasn't able to reveal who his patients were, except for some of these celebrity mm-hmm. patients who are featured in the film and elsewhere that, you know, have gone on record as saying they were mm-hmm. treated by Dr. Sarno, and essentially they call him a lifesaver, that he saved their lives.
Right.
But is that, did you come across that his physician colleagues would often disparage him, maybe not publicly, but in the, you know, the physician dining rooms, but then go see him because he could help them with their own pain, back issues, or psychosomatic illnesses?
I think maybe what the writer of that was referring to was the fact, not so much that the ones who would disparage him directly would come and see him, but they would come and see him and get better, but not refer anybody to him. And that was, I think that was probably hard for him to reconcile. But and I think, you know, you see it, there's a 2020 piece. I mean, one of the interesting things about Dr. Sarna is there's almost no media about him whatsoever that exists. And so there was this one 1999, 2020 piece by John Stossel. And in it, one of his colleagues who points to an MRI and says, you know, these things are all physical, says about Dr. Sarna, well, you know, you could go to a cemetery and swing a cat around your head 13 times or go to see Dr. Sarna. Neither of them is going to hurt you, but I don't think they're going to help you either. So this was his colleague saying this directly about him, and that guy still works there.
Wow.
So that was the environment that he was in, yeah. So that was hard. I mean, it was very hard for him to recognize, to know. I mean, and I think actually it's an interesting phenomenon that people who find Dr. Sarna, as a lot of them become somewhat proselytizing. They want everyone to know, and they want to tell people about it. But what happens is you start to do that, and people say, you're saying it's all in my head, and you lose friends. People don't want to talk to you, which is one of the reasons it was very difficult to make the film. And so we had to find this very, very careful balance of not having the film feel like it's proselytizing, because we didn't want to proselytize. And we also didn't want to turn the film into a thing that made Dr. Sarna seem just completely like a hero, and, you know, that felt unbalanced. And I think we were somewhat successful in finding a way to tell his story and show what incredible things he did without pushing people away because it felt like it was advertising or selling something. I mean, one of the things about Dr. Sarna is people are like, oh, he's just selling something. You mean he's selling like a $3 trade paperback book that he's not making any money on? You know, he just wanted people to get better.
Right. And Jonathan Ames, who you also feature in the film, who is somewhat of a celebrity, I think, in like an HBO director, among other things, you know, he points out that Dr. Sarna, if you're successful with him, you may have a consultation with him once or twice, but he's not the kind of doctor who's going to keep, you're going to keep returning to necessarily and paying lots of fees to.
Yeah, one of his patients in the movie is Dr. Seidenberg, who is a dermatologist in NYU, who had terrible back pain, refused to think about Sarna when his sister-in-law told him, you know, you should read this book. He thought it was ridiculous. A year later, he finally read the book and completely recovered. And so what he says is that he realized that the same thing was going on for most of his dermatology patients. And he realized that, like, so when women came in the spring, he would, you know, with crazy breakouts, he would say, so when are you getting married? And they'd say, how do you know? Oh, because this is what happens when people get married. They get really stressed out and they get better. And he said, you know, it's just a practice killer because people come to you, they get better and they don't come back. But he owes it to Dr. Sarna to do this for patients.
Yeah, that was really an interesting part of the film. And it's called All the Rage, Saved by Sarna. And it's created, among others, by my guest today, Michael Galinsky, along with his wife, Suki Holly, and another director. And it's going to screen in Tulsa on October 26th, which is a Thursday night, at the Circle Cinema. And we will post that link again to our website so you can purchase tickets in advance. Michael Galinsky, congratulations on the film, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our interviews, you can stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer just by going to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.